This is the BBC.
Thanks for downloading this programme from the BBC. Here's a little free extra for you. I think you'll find it absolutely fascinating. David Anderson, QC, goes under the skin of the government's counter-extremism strategy in Understanding Prevent.
May 2017, emergency services race to the Manchester Arena, where 22-year-old Salman Abedi has detonated a homemade suicide bomb, killing himself and 22 adults and children, injuring some 250 more. It was the deadliest terrorist attack in the UK since the 7/7 bombings of 2005. And not for the first time, the perpetrator was born and educated in this country. I'm David Anderson, and until March of this year, I was the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. I reported to the Home Secretary and to Parliament on the tough laws we need to keep the threat under control. Police powers, prosecutions, port controls, surveillance. But if the problem is ever going to be solved, we also need to win the war for hearts and minds. That is the domain of Prevent, the government's strategy to stop people being drawn into terrorism, whether in school, on the internet, in universities, or in prison. I'll be exploring whether Prevent is a spying programme, as its critics claim, or a vital tool in bringing young men and women back from the brink of terrorism, whether violent jihad or the re-emerging threat of the extreme right wing.
Well, came from a very broken home. Dad's always in and out of prison, mum's always in and out of prison. Same for my older brothers, cousins, uncles, everyone. A lot of drug use, violence, whether that be domestic or against other people. And there was a lot of racism within the family, especially from my dad's side. You know, he was a neo-Nazi skinhead. He was very big on how Jews control everything. He massively hated blacks. So he'd say things about Asians too, Muslims in particular, about how they were all paedophiles and, you know, like woman beaters, and he'd say that about blacks too.
And was this all words, or was he engaged in violence as well?
Words and violence, yeah. He used to go out with, you know, mates of his. They'd go out and, I don't know if I can use the word, they'd go out and they'd do a thing called packy bashing.
This is Marco, born into a bigoted and violent household. He followed in his father's footsteps, and in his teens began associating with far-right groups like the English Defence League, or EDL.
At first, it was just, you'd go down the pub and there'd be some of the older lot there that were involved. And then it'd branch out to them taking you out to go and do things, so like you'd go and vandalise the mosque or, you know.
So you got involved in that sort of thing, did you?
Yeah, that was quite normal. And then as I got a bit older, I mean, I've always been quite interested in, you know, things that go bang.
So were you making explosives, or were you using fireworks, or what was...
At the beginning, it was just get a bit of pipe, very, very basic, rudimentary.
So you started making pipe bombs?
Yeah, started, and then progressed to ordering chemicals off of the internet, you know, making higher level of explosives.
And how did you learn to do this?
Mainly from people that I was involved with, who had been involved with stuff in Northern Ireland about 30, 40 years ago.
But was that just lads having a bit of fun, making things go off, or was there a really serious
intent? I'd call it training.
Training?
Training.
Training for what? What were you going to use them for?
Against Muslims. We was told there's going to be a race war coming.
Marco's transient life eventually took him to a hostel. While he was there, a member of staff picked up on his far-right views and his willingness to act on them. They made a phone call, and to cut a long story short, Marco agreed to engage with Prevent. A meeting was set up with a mentor on Prevent's de-radicalisation programme, Channel.
I was quite apprehensive, to be honest with you. I didn't know what Channel was, I didn't know about the Prevent programme, I didn't know any of it. I was that paranoid at that moment in time. I thought I'd been lied to, and I thought this was me getting set up to get evidence against me or something.
So big issues of trust at the start,
yeah,
on your side. How did he win your trust? How long did it take?
Well, living the life I've lived, I'm a very good, you know, judge of character. I can read someone like a book, and I met him straight away. Off the back, I could tell he was genuine. Within the first few sessions, you know, I trusted him implicitly. I felt like I'd speak to him about anything.
And did you understand why he was there and what he was trying to do?
He was just trying to offer me a fresh perspective, and in such a way that it didn't feel like it was being forced, or it didn't feel like if I didn't agree, then you know, I was in the wrong.
And how long did you meet him for? Is this weeks, months,
over,
years?
It was over a few months, yeah.
A few months?
Yeah, over a few months.
And was there a moment in that time when the penny dropped, or was it a very gradual process of...
It was like with each session, a bigger part of my head would be saying, you know, he's right, you know, and it'd get more and more with each session as we went on. And then, eventually the penny dropped and I thought, you know, I've been living my life under a rock if I thought that all of these things are true.
Do you think this is something you would have eventually realised anyway for yourself without any need for channel?
No.
Why is that?
Because I was so heavily entrenched into that way of thinking that my life would probably be in a very different place and not a very positive one at that.
As in Marco's case, a Prevent referral starts with a phone call to a local authority or the police. If the concerns reported are legitimate and the person referred might benefit from an intervention, they're passed to Channel, the front line of Prevent. Channel cases are discussed at a so-called Channel panel, a meeting hosted by a local authority involving youth services, drug services, maybe a teacher if the referral was made by a school. The panel decides the best plan of action. Sometimes the individual may be paired with a mentor.
I do prefer the term mentor as well, because it's, you know, I see very much what I do as a supportive process.
Nick Daines is a psychologist who has studied religion, but these days mainly works with Prevent referrals concerning the far right. He's been a Channel mentor for 9 years now, and is the man who helped Marco turn his life around.
I specifically address areas around behaviour, but also around thinking. And it's always about providing a non-judgmental approach, really, and trying to encourage that person to consider alternatives, to provide kind of logical analysis to situations, to take a more difficult route, a more analytical route to what their perceptions are to other people.
When someone's referred for a channel intervention, do they have to do it?
It's entirely voluntary. It's not about forcing someone to take support, because that's entirely counterproductive.
So you don't think it should be compulsory?
No, not at all.
Why do you think they choose to cooperate with you when they don't have to?
Very much a large issue that I'm seeing in a lot of cases is that people feel socially judged these days, that they can't have a conversation around relevant issues, or they may be relevant to them and relevant socially, but they feel they can't express those opinions or attitudes without being kind of vilified. And it gives them the space to have these conversations in a safe environment.
And do you mentor them by listening, by talking to them? Are there other things that you do?
Yeah, definitely various different kind of, you know, methods of trying to rehumanise issues.
So how might you do that in practice?
For example, I worked with someone who has been involved in chapters of the KKK and also demonstrating very anti-Semitic and racially motivated views. So working, it was trying to reconnect their hatred to a more human element, so introducing them to survivors of the Holocaust. And we visited the Holocaust Centre up in Nottingham to try and show firsthand the stories of people that had been through these experiences.
Did it work?
Yeah, certainly did. You know, the individual that was involved has really kind of like disengaged from those kind of views that he held.
Prevent first came to public attention after the 7/7 attacks in 2005. A response from the then Labour government to the emergence of homegrown Islamist terrorism. But Prevent had been put in train some years earlier. Its creation was led by Sir David Omand, the former head of Britain's Signals Intelligence Centre, GCHQ, who had just started a new job.
I became Security Intelligence Coordinator in September 2002, so a year after 9/11. A lot of work had been done in that year to improve British security. But I thought there was a need to start casting our minds forward and actually think about it strategically. And we started work on something that I called Contest. That was a name I literally dreamt up in the bath, taking the phrase counter-terrorism strategy, picking out letters to make a word.
One of the four elements of Contest is Prevent. What was Prevent, as originally formulated, trying to prevent?
It was about Al-Qaeda and its related groups who held a particular ideology, one that was rejected by the enormous majority of Muslim populations around the world. It was a very specific form of ideology. And that's what we were trying to counter was any attractiveness that that ideology might have for young people.
More specifically, for young Muslims. Paul Thomas is a professor of youth and policy at Huddersfield University and has been researching Prevent since 2007.
It's beyond dispute that in the first phase of Prevent between 2007 and 2011, Prevent was explicitly only about Muslim communities. The government documents that launched Prevent talked about requiring a demonstrable change in attitudes amongst Muslims. The funding was allocated on the basis of how many Muslims lived in particular local authority areas. And local authorities that I worked with had it made very clear to them that they could only work with young Muslims, not with young people of different backgrounds. And from my point of view, that has really poisoned the image and reputation of Prevent from the start. There's still a public perception that this only focuses on Muslims.
Perhaps surprisingly, Prevent has never operated in Northern Ireland, where paramilitary activity is still, unfortunately, a fact of life. But under the coalition government, Prevent's focus began to change. It was extended to all forms of violent extremism, whether associated with militant Islam, neo-Nazism, animal rights, or other religions. And Prevent was broadened in another way too, as laid out by the then Prime Minister David Cameron in his landmark Munich speech of 2011.
As evidence emerges about the backgrounds of those convicted of terrorist offences, it is clear that many of them were initially influenced by what some have called non-violent extremists.
So Prevent's focus on violent extremism was widened to include non-violent extremism and threats to British values, such as democracy, liberty and tolerance. Then in 2015, the government imposed a statutory duty, a legal obligation, on councils, schools, NHS trusts, prison governors, even nursery school proprietors, to look for warning signs, including vocal and active opposition to fundamental British values. Individuals who are identified as vulnerable to being drawn into terrorism must be considered for referral to Channel. From the police's point of view, this has proved valuable.
We're certainly getting a lot more information. We're undoubtedly getting information now that we wouldn't have done in the past.
Detective Superintendent Nick Adams from West Yorkshire Police is the North East Regional Coordinator for Prevent.
When you look at the case of ambulance paramedics that went to call an address, and in that house, displayed on the wall, they saw images of beheadings. And they took the opportunity to ask a very simple, straightforward question of a young person in that address to say, you know, what are these pictures on the wall? And the young person's reply was, that's our religion. That generated a referral from the ambulance service.
While valuable to the police, this statutory duty has been hugely controversial too, especially when it comes to schools. Teaching unions have claimed the Prevent duty has caused suspicion in the classroom and cast staff in the role of spies. I've often been told that it's had a chilling effect in schools, fueling fears that saying the wrong thing could put you on the radar of the security services. That's the experience of Rob Four-Walker, a secondary school teacher in Tower Hamlets, who is now researching Prevent at University College London.
The school that I was teaching in was, I would describe it as a very emancipatory school. We made sure we empowered the children. We encouraged them to talk to us as equals. That led to this free-flowing of debate, which meant that we did constantly discuss what was going on in the news, what was in the press, and it meant that the children were perhaps more informed than in other schools that I've taught in.
So at that time, when Prevent first came into your schools, how did it actually affect your students?
Initially, it was a silencing, and teaching in Tower Hamlets, where between 70 and 90% of any classroom are Muslim, when the Muslim pupils stop talking, the classes do fall virtually silent.
Munadia Aftab is 19 years old and also from Tower Hamlets. Now bound for university, she says her school's attempts to protect her from extremism were heavy-handed.
What we'd have is people coming in from Prevent, people coming in from secular Muslim organisations. I mean, a lot of these Muslims came in and, you know, they have a different view and that's cool, but we didn't always share the same view. But it was made as though if I hadn't shared the same views as them, I was being extreme or I was an extremist. And I think that really affected me because, firstly, I'm totally against it, but I know where I stand when it comes to my faith. And having people come in and tell us how to be Muslim, it was insulting.
Well, were they telling you how to be Muslim, or were they simply telling you or showing you the advantages of tolerating other people, maybe people different from yourself?
See, that's another issue, because once you talk about tolerance and them saying that their way is tolerance, what they're basically insinuating is that I'm intolerant. you're not doing this, 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 this. You're not sipping tea and flagging the Union flag. You're not British enough.
Would you accept there are some extreme right-wing non-Muslims who are extremely intolerant of Muslims?
Yeah, I think there are people that aren't Muslims who are intolerant to Muslims.
And is it part of the job of the school to try and broaden those people's minds?
Yes, definitely. I think education from all parts is very important.
So is it not possible that there might be Muslims as well who are quite narrow-minded about some things?
Definitely.
And maybe it's the job of the school to try and broaden those minds as well?
Definitely. And that's my actual point, because once the prevent strategy kind of really came into play within schools, conversations had stopped.
This culture of silence is the opposite to what is intended in the government's prevent duty guidelines, which state that schools should make it easy for young people to discuss sensitive topics, including things they're angry about. For Ben Wallace, the security minister, prevent is all about keeping people safe.
From my point of view, as myself as a parent, is I want to know that when my children go to school, if someone's exploiting them for a sexual purpose or for bullying or into crime or into violent extremism, that there are steps taken to make sure they're safeguarded.
What was the thinking behind introducing the statutory duty, the prevent duty, in 2015?
It's about, I think, putting it on a footing to say, look, this is important, and therefore we don't want it to be put in a sort of it's too difficult box and people just ignore it, while at the same time carry on safeguarding in other areas. You know, it would be to think, David, I want to put one thing in perspective about prevent. You know, every year on average, there's about 620,000 referrals for other safeguarding issues. Prevent isn't even in that league. It's tiny.
Can you give us an idea about what those figures are?
Since 2012, we've seen about 1,000 people go on from a prevent referral into the voluntary channel programme, where they are provided with more support. Roughly about 25% are far-right extremists. The number of people who have gone through that has had some considerable success, including diverting 150 people who were on their way to travel to fight in Syria, we think.
It's a very difficult thing to judge, isn't it, whether an intervention has a particular effect?
It's hard to judge without just doing case by case, but this is the state trying to attempt to deal with a cohort of people that are vulnerable to exploitation and make sure we divert them away from the worst outcome.
But for teacher Rob Four Walker, prevent threatens more than it reassures.
It is scary when two police officers turn up and interview a child without their parents.
Did this happen in your class?
I've seen, not in my classroom, but I've seen it happening in the school that I worked in previously, and I've heard about it happening in many other instances. And that's a rare thing to happen in a school, that a child could be interviewed without their parents being told about it.
Did you ever feel that as a teacher, subject to the prevent duty, you were expected to gather information on your pupils for the benefit of the state?
Yeah, I think it's quite clear that under the prevent duty, teachers are expected to be informants, yes.
The narrative that prevent is a spying programme which puts British Muslims under unique scrutiny has developed huge traction in media and social media. I've said in the past that this makes it a subject crying out for fact-based independent review. Well, earlier this month, a study was published exploring how prevent works in schools in England. Professor Paul Thomas is one of the report's authors. He carried out in-depth field research in 14 schools and colleges in London and Yorkshire and spoke to over 300 teachers and practitioners.
We expected to find a lot of opposition or even resistance from teachers and other staff in schools and colleges.
And did your research confirm those initial fears?
Our research has actually found surprisingly little resistance and not even much opposition from people who work in schools and colleges to the duty.
People have spoken of a chilling effect imposed by the prevent duty. Is that a genuine concern?
Our research says that teachers and other college and school staff feel that there is no chilling effect. In fact, many of them offered us very strong evidence from their own schools of how they have increased open debate through special events. One school, for instance, gave an example of how they'd started a debating society with support from the local authority and were encouraging young people to debate difficult political issues.
That all seems to be rather the opposite of what we hear from the National Union of Teachers and what we read in
some of the newspapers. What's your take on that?
Some of that I think we explain by the fact that there's a well-established, more general concept of policy enactment by which schools quite often will change government policies. They will moderate them and mediate them in the way they do things in their day-to-day practice, which makes the actual implementation look quite different from the wording and tone and maybe even the intent of the national policy.
At Carlton Bolling College in Bradford, a class of 11 and 12-year-olds is discussing extremism in all its forms.
OK, year seven. The cycle of hate, well, which we just looked at, is used in all walks of life. So we see in religious extremism, we see homophobic extremism, racial extremism, political extremism. So if we go back to our...
The school got a head start on implementing Prevent back in 2014, a year before the statutory duty came in, and following the so-called Trojan horse scandal. Some Muslim governors were accused of trying to impose highly conservative values on the school, and Ofsted placed it in special measures for failing to protect students from radicalisation.
Once the school was actually put into special measures, during that year, there was a programme that was presented to the school. I looked through that programme and I had some serious concerns regarding that.
Hafiz Rehman is both an imam and an English teacher at Carlton Bolling College, and he's the school's lead on its counter-extremism work. When he received the government-issued Prevent teaching materials, he wasn't impressed.
The reason I felt it was unsuitable at the time, it was not only myself, but a consensus right across the school that this material, I would say, targeting the Muslim community itself. There were flashes of the elements of extremism, but a very significant focus on Islamic extremism, which actually kind of makes them feel guilty before they've actually done anything.
And so Carlton Bolling College has gone its own way. It fulfils the purpose of its Prevent duty, but through a programme it has designed itself. Here's head teacher Adrian Neeshaw.
In business world, you call it glocalisation, don't you? Global message, local delivery. A Bradfordisation, we've had it described as. Work with people who know how to communicate and are trusted with the people you want to communicate with. More effective message. Some person from London who imposes a system on someone locally, I think, are often doomed to failure.
Do you use the word prevent within the school?
No, we have, you know, getting on together. We use terms like this and things because, to be fair, the term prevent can be viewed pejoratively and, you know, negatively. We recognise that and we call it getting on together. A far more positive way of doing it, I think, reflects our bespoke way of doing things.
Around 95% of Carlton Bolling College's students are British Asian, the majority of them Muslim. And perception among these students about the so-called chilling effect couldn't be more different to that we heard about earlier in Tower Hamlets.
Do any of you worry that you can't discuss issues around terrorism in school in case someone picks up on it and gets anxious about it and reports you?
I don't think, to be honest, it's like that because we've openly discussed it within assemblies. There is a side to it where you can say your feelings on it without being looked down upon.
Yeah, I agree with that because we almost have like a sort of a personal bond, so we can talk about some personal things with the teachers that allow us to discuss our true feelings. Like, we don't have to think that we have to stick to what's right. We can talk about our personal feelings and the teacher will support us.
So, a school atmosphere conducive to discussion where Muslim students feel they can talk freely about difficult issues. It's everything Prevent was meant to be, though Carlton Bolling College felt they could only achieve it by rejecting the government's materials. And it has never made a Prevent referral. Not all schools with Muslim pupils have an imam on their staff who can finally tune the Prevent strategy to fit both the social and spiritual needs of their students. A criticism often heard is that an hour or two's training is not enough to equip public servants for their new responsibilities, and that this has led to an attitude of cover your back, if in doubt, refer. Detective Superintendent Nick Adams.
What that saw, certainly in the early stages, was significant rise in referrals. And over time, through education, through training, through providing feedback about the sorts of information that we've had, we've now got to a point where the threshold that people apply in other organisations before they come forward and report has reached what I would consider to be quite a mature, pragmatic level. So we now don't get through some of the really low-level referrals that we may have once seen in the early stages of the duty. What we've got now is a much better understanding of what should a referral actually look like.
That sounds rather encouraging. The quality of referrals may be improving after a shaky start. But according to the National Police Chiefs Council, there were still some 7,500 referrals in the year 2015-16, the equivalent of 20 a day. And you're unlikely to feel reassured if you are one of the people wrongly referred. Take the case of Kay, a mother from Bedfordshire. In early 2016, the day after terrorist attacks in Brussels, she went to pick up her two young boys from primary school and had a shocking surprise.
I had come into school a little earlier, before the 5 minutes before the bell rang, which I'd pre-arranged with their class teachers in order to pick them up to take them to an evening event. And I wanted to miss the sort of rush of the school run and the parking and so on. And I arrived in reception, the head teacher was there, and I was in quite a good mood. And I said, oh, no boys. And she said quite ominously, there's been an incident and I'm afraid the police have been called. And obviously I had a million questions, and she said, I'm afraid I can't tell you anything.
So the boys were 7 and 5.
That's right, yeah. Time.
They were being held by the school.
Yes.
As they waited for the police to arrive.
Yes.
But you couldn't be told what it was about.
No, I couldn't be told, and I couldn't see them.
So did the police then arrive?
The police arrived about an hour and a half after I'd got there. They were with the boys less than 10 minutes before they came to come and speak to me. And they said that they had received an allegation from the school that I had given them a real gun, or that I had a real gun. They were quite content that it had been a mistake, and that's what they said.
It's true, Kay had given her sons guns. Toy guns, 2 for £10 from the supermarket. Her eldest son had been speaking so excitedly about it that his teacher became concerned. The next day, Kay was told that the school had other concerns as well.
My oldest son's class teacher explained to me that they were concerned because he'd been displaying what they called a change in behaviour in the previous couple of months, and that he'd been speaking Arabic in class and talking about going to mosque with his father. Now, those aren't unusual things for a black or ethnic minority child to do, but it was all the more confusing because actually we're non-practising. My husband's a non-practising Muslim and I'm a non-practising Hindu.
So they hadn't been to a mosque?
No, none of my children have ever set my foot in a mosque. But it could have been fairly quickly cleared up with a quick chat to me, really, and I could have explained that to them.
Kay took her case to the human rights campaign group Liberty, and they took Central Bedfordshire Council to court, claiming that the school had discriminated against Kay's boys on the basis of race, the accusation being that they would never have reported white children for possessing a toy gun. The council accepted that and told us in a statement that it has reviewed its guidance to schools. But for Kay's sons, the event still lingers.
When the police came in, my older son later said to me that he thought that they were going to take him away. And when we came in, I took him upstairs away from it all, and I just sat on the bed while he had the most enormous meltdown because he was just so scared. And that night, both of the boys had nightmares. My young son, he said that he dreamt that someone came into the house and took him and his siblings away. And that's been a recurring theme, really, for both of them.
And Kay's case raises another concern. Here's Debalina Dasgupta, her solicitor from Liberty, to explain.
One of the major concerns that people raise when they contact me is, how is this information going to be used? How will that be held? How will that be disclosed? It's entirely shrouded in secrecy, and it's something of real concern. They're worried that at some point in the future it may come up. No matter how incompetent the referral, no matter how groundless, that information is probably held somewhere, and we still don't know how, and we don't know how it will be disclosed.
So is Prevent about intelligence gathering as well as just safeguarding? It's something I put to Detective Superintendent Nick Adams.
We're working in a pre-criminal space. Somebody who comes through Prevent does not get a criminal conviction or criminal sanction unless they're actually prosecuted for an offence. And as a result, for things like, you know, future job applications, for applications to universities, for travel visas, that information is not supplied, it's not provided. It doesn't form part of the National Police database.
But all the same, it sounds as though the police may have a file on people who've never been arrested or charged with a criminal offence.
There is an accumulation of information. I think the public would be horrified if we then just disposed of that information and didn't retain it so that we can assess, should we do some work with somebody, should that person actually be deemed to be, I suppose, out of the danger zone in terms of their risk of being drawn into terrorism, and then a further report is submitted about that person from somebody else, from some other organisation, months, if not years down the line, that we wouldn't consider that in the context of what we've done in the past. It would be remiss of us not to have that information available. I understand people's concerns around the stigma that is attached to a label that says you're an extremist or you're a terrorist. But in terms of people's concerns about information that may exist, what I can say is it's not held on some secret database. It's not shared overseas with people. The only cases where information is shared in terms of from an investigation point of view is where somebody is committing criminal acts or they're suspected of committing criminal acts.
Many of us want to know what intelligence the police can hold on us, for what purpose and for how long. Those questions are not confined to Prevent, and the more precisely they can be answered, the easier it will be to promote trust. Security Minister Ben Wallace agrees that the government needs to be more transparent, but says suspicion about Prevent has other causes too.
I think the government hasn't in the past enough stood up for it and explained it to people, and that's why I as a minister have decided that I want more of these figures published so people can see what's happening with their money and also with the initiative. I think also there are people who have a entirely opposite agenda and would like to see the Prevent policy taken down.
Today there is a strong anti-Prevent lobby active in Britain. And Sarah Khan, who has worked on Prevent-funded projects with her organisation Inspire, says working in counter-terrorism can be like walking into a minefield.
I would have never thought that by doing this work, as a Muslim, you would be called an apostate, a sellout, a native informant, receive sometimes death threats, a whole load of tweets saying that, you know, ISIS are going to come and gang rape you because you're delivering this campaign. And so it's a certain lobby who have made Prevent into a hot button issue. But I think actually the sentiment about Prevent is far more difficult to measure within Muslim communities as the fact that there are organisations who do by indeed support Prevent.
But if the opposition to Prevent is promoted by militant Islamist groups, why do you think it's been so influential with ordinary Muslims? I travel around the country a certain amount. I visit mosques, Islamic centres. I talk to Muslim families. And there is a degree of concern there and a degree of worry.
My experience has been different. I think there are many Muslims that support Prevent. There are many Muslims who actually don't really care about Prevent either. It doesn't bother them. It makes no impact on their lives. If you look at what the Islamist lobby have done so successfully, it's almost like they've weaponized Prevent to further on that narrative that there's a war by the West against Islam. There's an attempt to criminalise Islam and Muslims as a whole. So that kind of narrative is often also promoted under the guise of human rights and civil liberties. And I think well-meaning people, particularly on the liberal left, will say, well, look, this is a human rights issue. When I've had non-Muslim socialist men, for example, call Inspire a state-sponsored Islamophobe because our Making a Stand campaign was supported by Prevent, what does it tell us about the state of debate?
Sarah Khan didn't pin this counter-Prevent narrative on any particular group, and much of the abuse she has received has been anonymous. But one of the most prominent pressure groups opposing Prevent is CAGE, which describes itself as an advocacy organisation working to empower communities impacted by the war on terror. Asim Qureshi is CAGE's research director, and he told me about the broad-ranging concerns CAGE has about Prevent.
Well, I think that there are a number of problems with Prevent in relation to its transparency and accountability, in relation to its epistemology, and also in relation to the long-term consequences of the program. And I think that's where our critique really lies. It's about not only the rule of law, but about the long-term impacts and effects that this policy would have.
When you look at CAGE's writings and presentations on Prevent, you seem to concentrate, so far as I can see, entirely on negative aspects. But you have nothing positive to say about it at all.
OK, but David, let's imagine for a moment that CAGE didn't exist. Would those critiques of Prevent that we have disappear overnight? I don't think so. Any human rights organisation that takes its work seriously, that takes the rule of law seriously, would have exactly the same critiques.
But is CAGE actually motivated by an ulterior motive, as some critics claim? CAGE's record on being advocates of human rights has been called in question in the past, notably by Amnesty International, which issued a statement in 2015 saying that some of its positions on social issues were completely unacceptable and at odds with human rights. Evidence given by CAGE's Dr. Adnan Siddiqui to the Home Affairs Select Committee also raised questions about the group's political motives, when he said he was in favour of a caliphate.
Well, that was Dr. Adnan probably Siddiqui speaking in his own capacity there. I don't think CAGE has any view on that in one way or the other. I'm sure the non-Muslims who work in our organisation definitely aren't working towards any kind of caliphate, for sure.
But you're neutral as between democracy and a caliphate.
No, what I'm not neutral on is the rule of law. That is my commitment. It's interesting that you've circled around to some of these wider tangential issues. I think where that comes from is an anxiety that people have about who we are. And I think that in many ways is unjustified, because it's about the fact that you don't trust Muslims to have complicated views on things without wanting to see the end of Western civilization.
Critics like Cage would like to see Prevent scrapped. That's frustrating when stories like Marco's, which we heard earlier in the programme, show how valuable it can be. The government was surely right to apply Prevent to all forms of terrorism, not just the Islamist variety. But by extending it into vague concepts of British values and non-violent extremism, it has chosen a difficult road. Prevent's founder, Sir David Omond.
I have some doubts as to whether it was the right way, but I retired in 2005, so very much an outside observer. The risk in taking that approach was it was bringing together two separate strands of work. One part of counter-terrorism, focusing on potential risks of criminal violence. The other, a much more general objective about community cohesion, about our values. By bringing those two together, the risk was it would be perceived by the Muslim communities in Great Britain as being something that was actually hostile to them.
How far would you say the government has succeeded in selling the Prevent strategy to Muslim communities?
I would answer that sort of back to front by saying, if it's not accepted, then it's not going to be successful.
Perhaps Prevent is being asked to do too much. There are plenty of reasons for government to help promote tolerance, encourage critical thinking, and open closed minds. But try to do those things through a vehicle designed for counter-terrorism, and you have to work a lot harder to win people's trust. A home truth, perhaps, for the Home Secretary to ponder as she embarks this year on yet another review of Prevent.
Understanding Prevent was presented by David Anderson, produced by Richard Fenton Smith. The studio manager was James Beard, and the production coordinator was Jackie Johnson. Please do give us a review or a rating on the site where you get your podcasts. We'd really appreciate it. And podcast fans, can I recommend another great series, Profile, which each week tells the story behind a character in the news. Give yourself a treat and download the episode on Rob Gulston. Go on, do it now. You won't regret it.